Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. In the early 1830s, Eugénie Luce fled her husband and abandoned her family and moved to Algeria, where she became a major figure in the debates around educational politics and founded the first French school for Muslim girls in Algiers. Today I'm going to be speaking with Rebecca Rogers about her new book, entitled A French Woman's Imperial Story, Madame Luce in 19th Century Algeria. Hi, Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books in Biography today. I wonder if you could kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you very much for having me on this program. I'm an American who's spent most of her adult life in France, so that's conditions a lot the way in which I think about history. And I'm a specialist in girls' education, 19th century for the most part, and I've been working on that subject for a long time now, almost 30 years.
So when did you first encounter Madame Luce's story?
Well, as I mentioned, I've been working on girls' education, and I've become increasingly interested in the ways in which nuns in particular, but also some lay women, would moved into areas outside of France, the colonies, of course, but also England and the United States. And so in my second book, which I titled From the Salon to the Schoolroom, I devoted a final chapter to this effort to sort of spread a model of girls' education outside of France. And it's in that context that I first stumbled on the archives in Aix, where there's a very large dossier about Madame Luce, who's established the first school for Muslim girls in Algiers in 1845. And so she figures in my second book as one of a series of actresses who wanted to offer girls in various geographic areas lessons in French. But she was unusual, because she was a laywoman, and it's really mostly nuns who do this work because they've got the structure of the congregation behind them to allow them to set up risky educational institutions, whereas Madame Luce was on her own, and that's one of the reasons why she was so present in the archives, because she wanted the support of the French government in order to allow her to run this school for Muslim girls.
Okay, so what sources were most helpful to you in your research?
Well, this is a project that really started as an article, because I, having written a bit about her, I wrote about a paragraph or two in my second book. I thought, this is really a woman who deserves a little more attention. And as a historian of education, it's also a very interesting case, because she ends up getting a lot of attention by the French administration, who do support financially her institution. And so there are inspections. And so you can actually find out what's going on in the school. So I started thinking, okay, I'm going to do an article that allows us to see that women were active in the civilizing mission, as they say, in Algeria, and look really at the detail of the action that she was trying to do in the school, because I can see the sorts of lessons she was giving. I can see the sorts of prizes that she distributed. And so I started out doing that. And then serendipity, in many ways, I was spending half a year in the United States, and I gave a talk about her in Madison, and somebody in the audience asked me a question about what happened in the 1860s when her school, in fact, is closed down and becomes an embroidery workshop instead. And they said, so what's going on in terms of gender politics in Algeria in the 1860s? And I had to say I had no idea, because, in fact, scholars hadn't looked at those sorts of questions. And so I went into the library, and in France we don't have OpenStack libraries, but in the United States there are OpenStack libraries. And I just started looking at the documents, the books on Algeria, and I bumped into a book. I was in sort of the travel section, travel writers on Algeria, and I thought, well, maybe that's a good way to think about, you know, how did travelers talk about relationships between men and women and in the 1860s? And then I saw a title, Mrs. Rogers' trip to Algiers in 1863, 1864. And I thought, well, she's just calling to me, Mrs. Rogers. So I took down that book and I looked at the table of contents, and it's one of these very 19th century travel books with detailed descriptions of the sorts of places she visited. And she's the sort of pious woman who goes to visit, you know, orphanages and charitable activities. And I think, oh, she's perfect. You know, she's just the sort of woman I'm interested in. And then I find an entire chapter on Madame Luce in her book. And I was just bowled away because I found out all sorts of information about her childhood and the circumstances that led to her being in Algiers, which I had no idea. And then, relatively unusual for a travel source in the 19th century, she actually cited her source. And so I found that Brit the Feminist had actually profiled her in three essays in the English Woman's Journal. And so suddenly, thanks to this encounter with Mrs. Rogers, I had a whole other strand that I could follow, which was the British interest in this woman. And so that moved me to, you know, going to London, correspondences with the archivists at Oxford College, where you have British feminists' papers, notably Madame Barbara Bodichon's papers.
So this is quite a basic question, but who was Madame Luce?
Okay, that's a good question, because she's not really terribly well known. She was very well known in the mid-19th century in Algeria, but this book is partly an effort to put her back into history. She was born in 1804 and grew up in a lower middle class family in the provinces. She opened a school for girls at a time when there are not a lot of school for girls in France, and then for reasons that will always remain somewhat mysterious, abandoned her husband, left her 4-year-old daughter with her family, and moved to Algeria in 1832, just at the moment when the French are, you know, conquering Algeria. So she's there really in the early years, and emerges in the colonial archives in 1845, when she starts pestering the government to support a school that she has founded for Muslim girls. And she'll run this school from 1845 to 1861, so a relatively lengthy period of time. Over 1,000 girls attend the school during that time period. And then in 1861, the French government decides, and this is, of course, one of the crucial points in my book, decides that they don't want to support Arab girls learning French. They think this is in some ways a dangerous project, and instead they support lessons in sewing and embroidery. And so her institution becomes an embroidery workshop, which then will last until just before the World War I, carried on by her granddaughter. And so it's really the story of an institution, a school and a workshop, and the women who are behind this institution for a big chunk of time.
So had she been involved in education in France? How did she become interested in education?
I mean, she did run a small school, but I think, and this is one of the arguments running through my book, is that she's very influenced by the dominant rhetoric in Algeria when she arrives, which is the rhetoric of the civilizing mission. So, of course, the French are doing horrible things in Algeria, but they're also defending their presence by saying they're opening schools, they're building hospitals, they're improving the infrastructure. And you have in Algeria the civil servants as well as the military presence is heavily dominated by Saint-Simonians. And so Saint-Simonians are people who really believe that through technology, progress, education, you can build a better world. And so my hypothesis is that she may in fact have encountered the Saint-Simonian message before she left for France, because the Saint-Simonian message was very open to women and did speak about equality between the sexes. And though she, she doesn't have a strong feminist message when she appears in the colonial archives, what she is saying is that you have to include women in the civilizing mission. And so she is in a way appropriating of the dominant male discourse at the time in order to push for this idea of educating girls. Now, one can see her as sort of an opportunist, taking advantage of a moment in the French colonial efforts in Algeria, but I think she's pretty committed to education, because you see that throughout her life. And and so even though she does in fact profit monetarily from running the school and this workshop, she really believes that you can't build a more egalitarian society by leaving out half of the population. And so she will consistently be arguing for the need to think about women, to think about girls, that these girls should be able to learn French. And then when that becomes inaudible, she then says that they really should be able to earn their own living.
So this is another basic question, but for listeners who may not know, where is Algeria and what was it like then?
Okay. So Algeria is in northern Africa. It's the French had been colonizers in the early modern period, but Algeria will be the really important colony for the French in the 19th and then the 20th century. They begin colonizing in 1830, and the years from 1830 really until the 1850s remain years of a considerable military struggle, as the Algerians don't necessarily welcome the French with open arms. And that story, of course, has been told a great deal, the violence of the conquest of Algeria. And so one of my goals in this book is to say that in fact women were present from the outset in Algeria. It's not just a military occupation, but you have lots of women, nuns, nurses, teachers like Madame Luce, who are opening schools for the most part for Europeans, so that her initiative is unusual, because it is the only school for years that is for Muslim girls. But that women are there. And then, of course, one of the things I didn't know at all when I began my work was the presence of the British. I mean, I just didn't know that, there was a lively colony of Brits, including lots of feminists who, beginning in the 1850s and then in the 1860s, spent the winter in Algeria because the climate is far more agreeable than in Great Britain. But you also have, and this is one of what lots of people have been emphasizing in recent work, it's a very cosmopolitan colony, because there's not just the French and there's not just the British, but there's also poor Sicilians and the Maltese and Spaniards who are present as well. So it's a very vibrant colony, which attracts a lot of cultural attention as well, because you've got the famous Orientalist painters who go to Algeria to paint pictures. So it's very much in people's imaginaries in the 19th century, well beyond France, because it is a settler colony.
So how shocking was it for a French woman to be on, or just a woman in general, to be on her own in Algeria then? Because she had left her husband in France and moved over there.
That's, I think that's one of the things that women's historians have shown is that Algeria attracts adventurous women, and that you do see quite a few women who are there clearly as a way to escape the shackles of being a woman in France. The Napoleonic Code in at the beginning of the 19th century gives married women, you know, married women essentially have the status of children. And so she would have found an opportunity to have a lot more space to do what she wanted in Algeria, especially having left behind her husband and her daughter. So there's neither issues of maternity or having to you know, listen to what her husband wanted her to do, and that's one of the things I discovered in the course of my research is thanks to the digitalization of birth and death certificates in Algeria. One day I was just sort of checking, and I discovered that she had an illegitimate child in 1835, which I had absolutely no idea. And then I discovered the illegitimate child died, and then. But she had not registered the child under her married name, but rather under the name her father's name, and then she had another illegitimate child in the 1840s, which clearly shows what demographic historians have shown as well, that women. Many children were born out of wedlock in Algeria, and that it was relatively accepted in these years in the 1830s and 1840s, although it contributes, of course, to the image of women in Algeria as being sort of more loose and not particularly moral women.
You write that she sought to effect a moral transformation through the schools. Can you discuss this a bit more, and also how her personal life had some impact upon that at times?
So she's from the outset when she's writing to get support for her schools, she's saying you're never going to be able to conquer a colony unless you get the women on board. So you have to convince the women that the presence of the French is a positive presence, and if you can get women to believe in that, well, within the families, they will educate their own children, their husbands, to accept the French presence. Now, of course, she's arguing as well that the French presence is doing a lot of bad things for Algerian society, that it's in fact ruining the local economy, that one of the effects of the French presence is a rise of prostitution amongst the Algerian population, and so that if you can get girls into these schools learning French, so that they will be able to spread the message of the French civilizing mission within their families, but also learning a useful trade in terms of sewing and embroidery, that you will also be resolving these moral issues which are partly the product of the French presence, and this is important in her argument. It's important to the military officials who ultimately support her institution, but this argument is going to turn against her as well because they discover over the course of the sort of 2 years when she's to support her school, that in fact she herself has not led such a blameless life, and that the man whom she's living with, whom everyone had assumed was her husband, is in fact not her husband, that her husband was left behind in France. And this comes out when the husband conveniently dies, and she goes back to France to get the money from the heritage, because for reasons I will never be able to fathom, he had not sort of written her out of his life, and so she comes back with as a widow with money from her inheritance, and it becomes clear that, you know, she has not been providing a good moral example because she's been living with a man who was not her husband. And so she very quickly remarries this man to, you know, give the proper representation. In 1861, that in the debates about should we be teaching Muslim girls French, both Muslim notables as well as French administrators will say, this is a woman with very equivocal morals, upstanding families would never send their daughters to her school because she's got this whiff of immorality about her that lingers and that will then play against the existence of the school in 1861.
So do we have any idea what the attitude of the men in charge, the prefects, for example, was toward her, aside from these accusations of her being immoral? Just in the everyday, how did they respond to her? Do we know that?
Things I show in my book is that by looking at this woman, the 1860s, you see a real change in the cultural politics with respect to women. And in particular, what you see is that she loses support by the French because the French are concerned to rally Algerian notables, and it's Algerian notable men that they're seeking to rally. And these men are not at all crazy at the idea of having their daughters being educated in their school. And they will, in fact, state very clearly that the girls who go to the school become concubines for Europeans or prostitutes, and that, you know, no respectable family would send their daughter. And if the French are somewhat skeptical about this argument, they don't want to create waves in the 1860s. And so they accept the idea that the girls will no longer learn French, but instead they will learn a trade and will be less visible in the French civilizing mission.
Which brings us to my next question, because I really want to talk about the emphasis on needlework, which was fascinating to me. Yeah. About you had the mentioning of the savings accounts and how she was trying to give them economic independence. I thought that was really fascinating. Can you talk about that a bit?
And that's something that I was really very interested in because, and that's where looking at the British feminist reaction was very useful to me, because you see the British women are impressed by the ways in which she offers Algerian women a trade. And so thanks to that British, the way in which the British women talk about her, I became much more interested in the products that were produced and finding out more about that, because of the big hole in my biography is being able to get the voices of the women that she educated. I don't have those voices at all. They haven't left written traces. But what has remained are the objects that they produced, and so that's what I explore in the final section of my book, where I really look at what I call the remains of the day, which is the legacy this school left in terms of art. I mean, in producing objects which are considered part of a cultural patrimony. But then you also, of course, see the economic aspects of this. And here, the British, the Murray's Guide to Algeria, from the 1870s until the early 20th century, all urge British tourists to go buy these products at the school. And Madame Luce and then her granddaughter very much cater to what is becoming an emerging tourist industry within Algeria. And I think that's a story that we really don't know very much at all. Much more sort of naked women on postcards that come to mind, not little girls sitting at hand looms embroidering handkerchiefs, which are then going to be sold to the British and American tourists who are coming to Algiers in those years.
And you mentioned her granddaughter. Towards the end of the book, you have a kind of a rundown of other people's impressions of Madame Luce. And one of the most fascinating to me was her granddaughter, who wrote, I think, in a memoir, seemed to imply that she wasn't an adventurer at all, and she lived a very quiet, organized life, which you say was because she was older, and so her granddaughter had no idea of what she'd done before, or the full extent of it. How did those impressions of other people inform what you wrote? Or how you saw the story?
All of those different
ways of presenting her, I found just fascinating, because this is my first venture into biography. And it I was really very struck by how difficult it is to get any sort of coherent portrait, especially of a woman like this, who's never left any sort of memoir or much. I mean, I found four letters from her in the course of my research. So we don't have... everything we know about her is via other people for the most part. I mean, aside from those initial documents in the colonial archives, and the fact that I had read well before beginning this biography the memoirs of actually her great daughter. Your source. And it's true that this great granddaughter has this picture of her great grandmother as, she describes her as very bourgeois. She's relatively fat at the end of her life, liking good food and wine. She leaves a lot of wine bottles behind when she dies. And probably, you know, and that is the woman she knew. I mean, but she knew a woman who was in her 70s and whose descriptions of her life in Algeria obviously left out the juicier morsels. I mean, she's, you know, certainly Madame Luce did not divulge the more private, intimate aspects of her Algeria, notably the illegitimate children that she had as well. And I think, you know, by the 1870s and 1880s, the climate, the political climate in France had changed. Certainly the political climate in Algeria had changed. And so, you know, what we see is a young girl's memories of an, you know, an older woman whom she admired a great deal, but whom she didn't see as somebody who was... really, she certainly would have described her as a feminist, and I think that's, you know, that's really quite interesting, given given how unusual her initiative was when she first founded the school.
So, what do you see as the legacy of the story of Madame Luce?
I mean, I think on the one hand, it's there's a sort of historiographic issue, which is to tell French historians of empire that you need to pay attention to the women who were present in the colonization of Algeria, in particular, that they were present. But it's not just recognizing they were present, but seeing that they were actors, producing knowledge, producing institutions, and that when we knowing more about them does change the story we have of this colonization, and it not only does it introduce more complexity, but it's a way of understanding different moments where colonial politics changes, and taking seriously the ways women contributed to these changes. But I think there's another more contemporary legacy, which is, you know, I was very struck when I started looking at, you know, what remains of the of this story, and in particular in the ceremonies celebrating the centennial of the conquest of Algeria, Madame Luce is mentioned, but she's no longer mentioned as a school teacher teaching Algerian girls how to speak French. And in France, the relationship to the language is very, very intense. Instead, she's presented as the grandmother of Algerian art. As a woman who taught girls how to embroider, and I think that legacy is important because it allows us to understand how girls' education drops off of the colonial agenda in many ways, with very long-lasting effects for the education of girls. And I think for, you know, 20th century historians of Algeria, one needs to take that into account to understand why girls remain so systematically undereducated compared to the boys. And then I think we really need to look more carefully at all of these craft schools and professional schools that in France we tend to not pay as much attention to, because they're considered more lowly because they're not teaching what French culture so admires, which is the French language. So I think it is a way of sort of questioning the ways in which we read the past and institutions that ultimately made a great deal of left a legacy for the Algerians after independence.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about a French woman's imperial story and for your patience in a conversation plagued by technical difficulties. Do you have any idea who you'll be writing about next?
At the moment, I'm looking at women in universal exhibitions, because that was one of the things that I encountered in this story as well, is how Madame Luce seeks to make herself known through universal exhibitions, so giving her institution visibility to all of the countries who attend these exhibitions. And that's made me want to think more seriously about how women use those particular venues to claim an importance in the economies of their countries. Now, I'm not sure who I might be working on, but maybe a group of women as a result.
I've been talking today with Rebecca Rogers about her book, A French Woman's Imperial Story. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books in Biography. Thanks for listening.